You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, December 4th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, following the failure of a grand jury to bring any charges against the police officer who, according to a medical examiner in New York, committed a homicide via choking on Eric Garner. We'll be talking to Danny McLean, Nation Institute Fellow. Also on the program today, the protests over the failure of a grand jury in Ferguson to indict a police officer who shot and killed another unarmed African-American man. Run into the protests, people protesting the failure of the grand jury in Staten Island to bring charges against an officer who killed another unarmed African American. And the cop who shot the 12-year-old African American boy in Cleveland upon 2 seconds, literally 2 seconds, upon driving up on him. Turns out, in his prior job as a suburban cop, he was found to be severely lacking in ability. Meanwhile, other stuff. We'll get to it. There are major strikes taking place in 150 cities across the country today, looking for $15 an hour wages. And this coming on the heels of, I believe it was Chicago, raising its minimum wage to $13 an hour. And we're seeing the impact of this as this movement grows and continues to put pressure on both industry and lawmakers to raise the minimum wage in this country to something that's remotely more of a livable wage. We will get to that today as well. First off, let's just hear some of the sound of protesters last night in New York City. They shut down the West Side Highway, shut down many streets at various times over the course of the day. I don't know how much the tree lighting ceremony was interrupted. That seemed to be the concern of a lot of news talking heads from various from Fox and CNN. Just think about the children, not Garner's six children. Just think about the other children. But here is just some of the protesters at Grand Central Station shouting really what ended up being the last words literally, of Eric Garner as he was being choked to death by a police officer. In fact, Eric Garner's last words, you can find them. They were on, people were posting them on Twitter yesterday. Every time you see me, you want to mess with me. This is as the police are coming up on him because he was supposedly selling loose cigarettes. And I think in the first wave, there was like at least two or three, maybe four cops. Every time you see me, you want to mess with me. I'm tired of it. It stops today. I'm minding my business, officer. I'm minding my business. Please just leave me alone. I told you the last time, please just leave me alone. Please, please don't touch me. Don't touch me. And then as he's on the ground with a knee in his head, shoving his face into the ground with a guy's arm, this police officer's arm around his neck. I can't breathe. 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 And then he basically went unconscious. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Danny McLean. Back on the Majority Report on the phone, Danny McLean, a contributor to the nationmagazine.com and a Nation Institute fellow. Danny, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So I want to get your, I mean, you had a great piece, I guess it was now about a week ago, in the wake of the failure of a Ferguson grand jury to indict Darren Wilson. And now in New York, in a case that may be in some ways even more shocking, and probably is. I mean, there's video, there's a report from a medical examiner that that Eric Garner was the victim of a homicide as a function of his chest and neck being crushed, essentially, by the police. And a failure to indict the police on anything. Give me your reactions, I guess.
Well, I would say my reaction is one of deep curiosity and wonder around what people who are curious. Not curious, people who are outraged and people who are devastated and saddened by these events, what they're going to do in response. I mean, I don't really have much to say about the Staten Island grand jury's decision not to indict the officer who killed Eric Garner, because you know, as you pointed out, we have the video, we have the coroner, you know, saying that this was homicide by chokehold. So the facts seem pretty clear. I think at this point, what is more interesting to me is how will people respond? You know, there are protests all over New York City last night that are just building on the wave of national protests coming out of, you know, the Ferguson grand jury's decision not to indict Wilson. This feels like an incredibly important moment with real revolutionary or evolutionary potential. I think there are people within the organizing and activist communities who have long been well aware that Black people are killed by police every 28 hours. At least that's the stat according to a Malcolm X grassroots report that came out of 2012. So there's a way in which, you know, social media is lifting up these cases. Mainstream news is finally paying attention to these cases, and kind of an awareness of how frequent and how apparently unlawful, you know, some of these police shootings are. That awareness seems to be growing from, you know, just the community of people who pay close attention to these issues to the general public. So I think we're at this moment where it's like, what are we going to do with this information now that a critical mass seems to be aware and seems to be outraged and is taking to the streets? What is going to be the movement, you know, the forward-looking, visionary, long-term movement that grows out of these killings by police and the exoneration or the failure of grand juries to even indict, even bring to trial the police officers responsible for killing these people?
Do you think the movement is going to be, I mean, to the extent that there is one, I mean, it's hard for us to know what will happen in the days and weeks and months to come, but is it your sense, you know, that the outrage is limited to the idea of unarmed Black men being shot, as opposed to, I don't know. I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, like, for instance, on Twitter, we're seeing like this hashtag Alive While Black. And from my perspective, as a white guy who really doesn't go through any of this experience whatsoever outside of, you know, doesn't live this experience, the fact that Black men, unarmed Black men, are shot at this rate by the police is simply sort of the mile marker that we see, or the watershed, and there it is backfilled by a daily experience that is lived that is, you know, doesn't make the newspapers. But it's one that Black people are far more conscious of because they live it on a daily basis, and it doesn't have to be they're getting shot. It is they are suspect on some level because they're Black.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's fascinating, right? I think, you know, over 100 years ago, you know, in 1903, with his writing of The Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois was writing about this double consciousness and this idea of the veil, that Black Americans have a lived experience which we are aware of, and we both live within that experience and are able to see, you know, how non-Black people at that time, he was writing about how the white world lived, and we're very aware of, a different standard, a different set of circumstances, an overall different experience that white Americans could expect to have. What I think is happening now is that veil in some ways is being pulled back, and white Americans, if they hadn't been aware before, you know, are becoming aware. And even beyond becoming aware, seem to be taking an interest in better understanding and figuring out some way to act, given that Black people are treated so differently, particularly at the hands of law enforcement. So, you know, it's interesting. I was reading something, you know, I think it was like a reporter, an editor at the Washington Post, saying he was, you know, shocked when he learned about this idea of the talk, you know, this idea that Black parents have to talk with their children, particularly their boys, about how to behave. You know, never run in public, never have your hands in your pocket, lest it be assumed that you're reaching for some kind of firearm or you have something concealed. You know, this, I think, it is, it's interesting the way that we're starting to hear so many non-Black people talk about the shock that they feel at learning about the lessons that Black parents have to teach their children. And I shouldn't just say Black parents, I should say parents of Black children, because I thought one thing that was very interesting was Bill de Blasio,
yes,
the mayor of New York, talking about, you know, talking about the conversations that he and his wife have to have with their son, Dante. And, you know, he was talking about some conversation that he had with the president where President Obama said, you know, Dante looks a lot like what I look like at that age. So, you know, yeah, I mean, there's a different set of experiences that take place within Black homes. And it seems like right now is a moment where a lot of non-Black Americans are kind of waking up to that reality.
Yeah, I mean, that aspect of de Blasio, I mean, there's two things that sort of strike me. And it's, you know, on some level, I find myself as I am, you know, contemplating these things. You know, there's a certain inevitability that one's always going to see it through one's own perspective. But and the idea of it, this dynamic, which fundamentally is a reality for Black people in this country, but it much of the revelations, or I guess the I don't know what we're talking about, has to do with the sort of the awareness by white people. You know what I'm saying? Is that it's white people talking about this in the context of like, this has really raised my conscience. And as opposed to like, you know, it's the idea that, wow, it's only because now that we have a white mayor who has a
right.
a Black son or a mixed race son, that white people are becoming aware of this? Or it's only because like we've had this unbelievable, like almost incomprehensible, and maybe it's always been there, but now that we have it on with social media, there's a broader awareness of like just how often unarmed Black guys get shot as a way of introducing white people to the idea that like, you know, well, Black people really do have a different experience just on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. After the decision of the Ferguson grand jury not to indict Wilson came out, Color Lines did a really interesting roundup of responses from leading Black writers and thinkers. Just, you know, I think they were asked the basic question, what are your thoughts and feelings now that you've heard the news that Wilson won't face trial? And I think it was Joan Morgan who said to me, the response that most resonated with my own feelings, which was, I'm tired of Black people's deaths being used as teaching moments. Mm. We need to feel every bit of this pain. And that's where I am with this. It's like, that's great if white people are having their eyes opened. I'm very thankful to the commentators and the people who are active on social media who take that as their work to kind of help white people see. And I think at a certain point, that has to become the work of, from my perspective, that it's very nice and very helpful when that consciousness raising is done by white people who already have their consciousness raised, right? So that it doesn't become the work of Black activists to make a case for Black humanity to white people. Because that's, I think, when I think about some of the brilliant strategists and organizers and activists who are doing racial justice work who are Black, their time is much better spent strategizing, not, you know, convincing people who have had doubts that Black people are human beings. So, you know, it's, I just really was thankful for Joan Morgan, you know, advancing that idea of our lives are not teaching moments. When Black people lose their lives at the hands of police, and those police officers don't even face trial or are somehow exonerated by other means, or even these self-deputized people like George Zimmerman, you know, that's not, it's not just a teaching moment. It's also a moment for people who realize that could have been my child, that could have been my partner, to just grieve and to think very deeply about how to best respond you know, both within our communities and how to best respond in terms of policy and cultural shifts that have the potential to make a difference, not necessarily to use it as a moment to raise, you know, the consciousness of confused or, you know, doubtful Black people who haven't had much exposure to Black life. I'm sorry, white people who haven't had much exposure to Black life.
And so what is that? I mean, what is your sense? I mean, there are some sort of, I guess, policy goals that, you know, in a very narrow sense, seem to that are possible to come out of this to deal with some of this. And, you know, one being the idea of, you know, a special prosecutor who is. I guess authorized or is instituted to deal with things like police brutality. I mean, because it's quite clear that the grand jury system is used by district attorneys who don't want to bring charges as a way
right.
of not bringing charges and not having to take responsibility for not bringing charges. Letitia James in New York, anyways, who is the public advocate, is pushing this as a policy, obviously, for just for New York. But I mean, it seems to make some sense. But it also seems, on some level, that's a fairly limited, you know, that's a fairly limited goal to have in this context.
Oh, interesting. That's interesting. I mean, I think, well, you have to start somewhere, right? I mean, I think
right.
it's, I've been kind of reading, you know, like my colleague, Michael Denzel Smith wrote a piece on the Nation site maybe yesterday, and I've just been reading a lot, and there's this kind of deep, and I get it, but there's this deep pessimism right now, just kind of like, wow, again, like what do we do? You know, and then this conversation around, you know, the kind of semantics of the justice system is broken versus no, the justice system is working exactly the way it's always meant to work, right? By essentially, you know, there are two systems of justice, one for Black and brown bodies and the other for white bodies, or you might divide it by class and say, you know, that one for, you know, people with resources and one for poor people. I think that I find that pessimism a little frustrating, actually, because massive social change has never happened in this country without organizing, and organizing comes from a place of hope and optimism and the ability to vision something different. So, you know, what you just mentioned, this idea of having some kind of special prosecutor or leaving behind this system of grand juries, to me that sounds like an option. I mean, it sounds like a winnable goal. And, you know, your point about it being limited, I think that's right, but I think there are a whole set of reforms that, you know, need to be undertaken. I'm looking at the list of demands. There were a group of activists who have been, you know, present and on the front lines in Ferguson who met with President Obama and members of his administration. I think it was last week at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And these were organizers from Millennial Activists United, from Dream Defenders, from Make the Road by Walking in New York City, from the Ohio Students Association. And they put forth their own list of demands. And some of them seem kind of, you know, one of them is the demilitarization of local police departments. Okay, well, we could get a bit more specific about what we mean by that. You know, another is establishing community review boards that can make recommendations for police misconduct instead of allowing police departments to police themselves. So I'm so impressed and interested in these young people. Most of them are, you know, in their 20s. Who are tired of playing defense, right? They don't want to just organize a protest when something happens, like what we saw yesterday. They also want to try to attack these problems by pulling them out at their roots and constructing a kind of program for action that, you know, and they're making demands at the federal level, which I think is smart. I've been thinking so much this morning about the comparisons to be drawn with the civil rights movement. You know, when we look at those years in the 50s and 60s of mass mobilizations, people weren't just responding to the latest kind of racist or white supremacist terrorist act. They were also crafting what would become the Civil Rights Act, what would become the Voting Rights Act. And they used that mass mobilization in the streets to put pressure on LBJ and put pressure on Congress to pass their demands. And that's where we need to be right now. It's not just about taking to the streets when something terrible happens. It's about figuring out how to play defense, because that's important, but also figuring out an offensive plan that could be advanced so that we don't have to play defense so much.
It's interesting that you characterize those demands by those protesters who met with or organizers who met with President Obama. Like you say, I think it was at the beginning of this week or at the end of last week, as by the roots. Because, I mean, it seems to me that there's sort of like two sort of short circuits that took place here, or there was a failure of a short circuit. That being that people are outraged that this cop was not indicted by the grand jury. And then you know, anything that would have subsequently happened to that. In other words, the cop's indicted, goes to trial, may or may not be prosecuted. Had he not been prosecuted, there would also been, I think, based upon, you know, what we know of the evidence at this point, and I don't like to get involved in, like, the minutiae of court cases, but there may have been some very justifiable outrage if he was in some way not found guilty. But there's also a problem just the moment that the guy gets out of his car and goes up and starts to harass Garner. I mean, that moment before Garner's dead is an extension and an illustration of a lived reality that is also extremely problematic and is as much as a function of what the police force is tasked with doing in our society and a reflection of what our society's values are. That is also, it seems to be, like, sort of deeply embedded in who we are as a country. And I guess the question is, you know, can you roll that back slowly with the more policy-oriented fixes that, you know, are actually not so much from the roots, but from the branches of that trunk of racism, I guess, to belabor this metaphor?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think, I think that there are policy solutions which create a container for, which, you know, set expectations, right? And then, as you say, there is a cultural change that needs to take place within police departments. I would argue that, you said that Wilson's actions in terms of even getting out of the car to confront Michael Brown, you know, need to be looked at. And I would say, you know, at a certain point, we have to look at the individual police officers. Are they making choices that are necessarily in line with police procedure or good police, best policing practices, you know, that have been upheld nationwide? So, for example, Ferguson is, you know, this kind of tiny suburb. It could be the case that, you know, what Wilson did was in line with police practices because they're not necessarily the most forward-looking, you know, police department. But it could also be the case that Wilson was just a terrible officer who went rogue, that he was acting at a certain point based on his own fears and his own deep-seated prejudices or assumptions or, you know, kind of expectations of what this interaction was going to be with this large, you know, tall, even though he was about the same height as Wilson, this young man. So I think what I'm trying to get at is that I think we have to look at how these individual officers' behavior and their own prejudices and their own fears are motivating their actions.
I think that's the case.
I think there is a cultural shift that needs to happen, and you're right in that we can't divorce this from racism, right? Because what is it that's causing a police officer to act one way towards a young black man that would cause him to act completely differently if it was a young white man? And I think that has to do with these kind of hair trigger responses that are deeply ingrained.
And it's also not the cops. I mean, like, you know, we played a video yesterday that was shot by a guy who was walking down the street in Pontiac, Michigan. And he is approached by a deputy sheriff who had gotten a call that this guy was suspicious. And this guy in Michigan had pulled out his phone and was videotaping the cop. And the cop, you know, in this instance, the cop was, I think, I don't know if it was a function of the video camera being there and this this guy saying, like, you know, the cop saying, like, is it bothering you that I'm stopping you? And him saying, yeah, it's bothering me. I mean, with everything that's going on in this country right now, I'm walking around because I'm black. I'm automatically suspect because I have my hands in my pocket and when it's 30 degrees out. And the cop seems to realize at this point, like, yeah, this is, you know, has a moment of humanity. And well, on some level, you also feel for the cop in this instance because it was clearly the fears of other people and imposing their racial prejudice on this guy who just happened to be walking by with his hands in his pockets that, you know, made the cop have to, you know, you get a call about a suspicious activity, you got to go. And he goes and he approaches him. He realizes, like, oh, this is bad. This is a bad situation. And so that's the – on one level, that's, you know, the cops are there as a manifestation of what our society, and by our society, I think I'm, you know, those who control our society, want, which is, you know, aggressive policing of black people in many respects. And, you know, when the cops in, you know, when Pantaleo, the cop who killed Garner, gets out of his car, he is basically, you know, just a typical cop who is used to this style of broken windows policing, and I'm going to go harass the low-level guys for selling cigarettes. And if I'm going to harass them properly, I got to be able to show them that I'm willing to take you down on the ground, push your face into the pavement, and choke you. And that's all a reflection of, you know, the cops at that point just are the hammer, and the rest of us, and by us, you know, the white power structure is just sort of swinging that hammer.
Yes, and I think that that's, I mean, just to circle back to an earlier moment in the conversation, I think that that is why it's so important for people who see themselves as part of that power structure, who see themselves as having the ears of that power structure, you know, who are seen as reasonable and, you know, able to use facts and evidence to try to engage in shifting the culture. I think there are always right-thinking, and by that I mean kind of, you know, people of conscience, people in every community. And I think this is a moment where that calls for real courage on the part of white people who, you know, will get on Twitter and retweet all the, you know, kind of, you know, retweet the black people who they follow or the social justice people who they follow, or they'll get on Facebook and repost, you know, articles from the right, you know, what they feel to be the kind of morally upstanding progressive publications. Okay, so get off social media and go have conversations with those neighbors who are the very ones that will call the police and turn a blind eye to, you know, excessive force when it's used on black people in their neighborhoods. And I think, you know, you bring up a question that we have to answer. And I think that this is a moment where we really need to accept that this is an American problem. This isn't black people's problem, right? I feel like we haven't quite understood that in this country. We haven't quite accepted it. Is that there is a role to be played, and it's not just kind of looking for, you know, black people to kind of be the moral compass. I think it's time for, you know, more white folks to stand up and not bow to the kind of activities that they see in their communities that they know in their hearts are wrong. So I am hoping that we see more of that.
Danny McLean, Nation Institute Fellow, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, before we go into the funner half, which I can't guarantee is going to be that much funner today, I want to play this clip. I don't do this very often, if ever, really. But there was a great segment that Chris Hayes had last night with Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I think is one of the best writers that we have, particularly online in the country, just in terms of a guy who's just a tremendous thinker. And he has, the exchange here, it's 5 or 6 minutes long. And some of you may have already seen it. And if so, I sort of apologize, although I think I've watched it now 2 or 3 times at least. And it's just a very thoughtful exchange. And Ta-Nehisi Coates is someone who both can express sort of the what is outrageous at the moment, but also see it in this broader context. Because I think, I agree with what Danny was saying in terms of this being an American problem, and it frankly has been not just an American problem as opposed to just a white or a black problem, but it is so deeply embedded in the identity of America. It's almost to the extent that this has been a problem for this country, it is almost one of those problems that you cannot divorce from the very existence of the problem. I mean, it is literally woven into the DNA of this country. And it has been the defining, most uniquely American problem, or the defining dilemma of America. And the tough part about dealing with it is that it's sort of hard to say what the benefit of solving it. Well, I should say sort of hard to convince the benefit of solving this problem to the established order and those who have control over the established order. In other words, I can sit here and articulate, what problems can be solved by certain policy prescriptions. But at the end of the day, it's not one of those that you say, like, oh, Lee, you're going to get 35% more efficiency if we are not subjugating black people in this country. And by subjugation, I mean, make no mistake. I mean, you just read this hashtag Alive While Black. It's really just more of the same. I mean, I've told this story 100 times on the show about just having some type of revelatory moment 20-some-odd years ago when I was doing a sitcom, which was a mixed white and black sitcom, like literally comedic styles combined. And was having lunch at one of my buddy's houses, and his buddy pulls in just saying, oh, God, I've been pulled over 5 times by the cops in the past 3 weeks for driving my Range Rover. And I called and said, can I get some type of sticker to put on my car that says I own this? So then I get pulled over, and the sergeant at the precinct house was like, are you black? Yes. There's not much I can do. I mean, and that type of stuff stuck with me because I know, particularly for someone who is such a sort of like I could relate to it oddly enough because of watching, in retrospect, Lenny Bruce's career
and seeing how his harassment by the police drove him down a wormhole and essentially destroyed him because he became so obsessed by it. And just thinking like, yeah, that's a personality trait I can relate to. And if I was a black guy who was driving a nice car and pulled over multiple times simply because I was a black guy driving a nice car, I don't think I could achieve anything. Like, I don't think I'd be able to sleep. I don't think I'd be able to get up in the morning and tie my shoes. I would be so obsessed and just consumed by this banal daily injustice. Maybe not so banal. And, you know, it's hard to say to white people in this, it's hard to make the case to white people in this country that, hey, we really should have a society where black people are not subjected to that extra baggage they got to carry around. As in, if I'm a parent, I've got to tell my kid, like, here's a special set of rules for you because you're black. Not just the burden it puts on the kid, but the burden it puts on the parents. It's hard to make the case to white people, like, you should really, it's going to be much better for society in general, and it's going to help these people actually sort of actually compete and integrate into society more if they don't have to walk around with this extra baggage. Because it necessarily means, like, you're going to lose a significant amount of your privilege, which is just, and you're not even aware of it. You're not even aware of the privilege that is involved with walking around and not having to deal with that. So on top of all the crap, like, is my kid's going to get, is my kid going to get a cold today? How is she doing in school? Is she getting along with her friends? Is she going to look both ways when she crosses the street? And then add on all of these other literally existential threats to the kid. Because she's black, or because he's black. That's just like, it's just like a drag. It's like running, yeah, I'm going to run the marathon this year, and I'm going to do it with a backpack full of weights. And none of the other marathon runners are going to be aware of the fact that, hey, they have a distinct advantage over me. All right, so let's play this this clip from Chris Hayes' program from last night. He starts off talking about he was on air while protests were going on in New York City. It's 6 minutes long, but I definitely think it's worth it. Let's play this.
West Side Highway here in New York, where it appears protesters have shut down part of the West Side Highway. This in response to the decision of the grand jury not to indict a police officer who put a chokehold or arm around the neck of Eric Garner as he said, "I can't breathe," 11 times before dying. Joining me now is Ta-Nehisi Coates, senior editor of The Atlantic. All right, Ta-Nehisi, where do we start with this? What was your reaction today when you heard the news?
I was surprised. I was not surprised. I was not shocked at all. I think we expect our grand juries to exist outside of the context, outside of the forces that, you know, affect ordinary human beings, ordinary Americans who live in this country. And that just isn't true. You know, laws, grand juries, all of our, you know, hallowed institutions, they are what the people make them to be, ultimately. They don't exist on some other plane, immune from other forces like American racism. So I'd like to say I was shocked and surprised. I was not, regrettably.
I saw you saying earlier today, or I think you might have tweeted this, the way we've been having this discussion is about the intersection of policing and racial bias. And
right.
You were saying, let's not hold the police out as an institution that is the one institution in American life particularly tainted by racial bias.
Right. Well, I mean, the history of this country is You know, we have this long history of racism in this country, and as it happens, the criminal justice system has been perhaps the most prominent instrument for administering racism. But the racism doesn't actually come from the criminal justice system. It doesn't come from the police. The police are, you know, pretty much doing, you know, what the society that, you know, they originate from want them to do. If you, you know, you can look at any number of studies on how African Americans are perceived in terms of criminality versus other Americans. You can look at the long history of criminalizing black people in this country, which did not begin with Eric Garner, which did not begin with Tamir Rice, which did not begin with John Crawford. This is a very, very old tradition in this country, and the expectation that the police, that our grand juries, that our prosecutors will exist outside of history is I think, a grave mistake. I think we have to, you know, come to some sort of terms with the country that we're living in.
Okay, so if that's true, then how do you avoid either fatalism or impotent rage? I mean, what, like, so... What do you do?
I don't know that you avoid infinite rage. I don't know that infinite rage can be, I walk around with it. You know, Baldwin talked about this, you know, to be black in America is to walk around, you know, all of fire, in rage constantly. So I don't know that you can, you know, avoid that. You know, in terms of avoiding fatalism, you know, listen, I'm the descendant of enslaved black people in this country. You could have been born in 1820 if you were black and looked back, you know, to your ancestors and saw nothing but slaves all the way back to 1619. Look forward another 50 or 60 years and saw nothing but slaves, you know, forward. There was no reason at that point in time to believe that emancipation was 40 or 50 years off. And yet folks resisted and folks fought on. So, you know, fatalism isn't really an option. Even if you think you're not going to, you know, necessarily win the fight today in your lifetime, in your child's lifetime, you still have to fight. I mean, it's kind of selfish to say that you're only going to fight for a victory that you will live to see. As an African-American, I mean, we stand on the shoulders of people who fought despite not seeing victories in their lifetime or even in their children's lifetime or even in their grandchildren's lifetime. So fatalism isn't really an option.
Right now, as you and I are talking, Ta-Nehisi, there's an image that we're showing of folks who are marching down, I believe that is the West Side Highway, and they've shut it down. There have been a wave of protests ever since that grand jury decision was announced in Ferguson over a week ago. And one of the things I think that you keep pointing out in your writing is that at the time that protests happen, a lot of people are talking about how they're not the right kind of protest. They're too disruptive,
right,
or they're not accomplishing the right thing. And then 40 years later, 50 years later, the people who organize them get put on stamps. But then we forget that when they were actually happening, people were thought they were too disruptive.
Listen, the protest is against, you know, the policies, you know, or the inaction of policies by the American state. To expect the American state to then approve those protests at the same time is a little insane. It's easy to approve the protests 40 years later, you know, when you don't have to deal with Martin Luther King, when you're not Bobby Kennedy and having, you know, to worry about, you know, balancing laws, you know, federal laws and state laws. But people in that time, in the time of the actual protest, you know, don't approve. In fact, if a protest that's approved of isn't, you know, it kind of defeats
itself.
It's not actually a protest. It's not a protest. What are you protesting, you know, if everybody agrees?
Ta-Nehisi, where do you think... Do you think right now there is something about this moment that's kind of galvanized? I mean, it just feels today like on the heels of what happened in Ferguson with the video of the shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, with the way that social media operates and the camera phones operating, we now have a kind of consciousness of what's happening that we weren't able to get before in quite the same way. And whether that galvanizes something nationally, what do you think?
Maybe. Maybe. I don't know. I hope so. I would like to think so. I would like to think that, you know, what effectively was the drive-by killing of an 11-year-old child would galvanize something. But Chris, I really hate to keep going back to this, but, you know, we are under the weight of some 350 years of state-sanctioned racism and about 50 years of just halfway trying to dig our way out of that. To expect things to change because, you know, a few cases over the past few months, I think it's to expect too much. This is a long, long, long fight. I'm not calling for fatalism. I'm not calling, you know, for giving up. But, you know, we ought to be tougher than to just, you know, expect that, you know, oh, because suddenly we're aware, those of us who, you know, watch and love MSNBC are aware, that necessarily means the change is around the corner.
Ta-Nehisi.
All right. And so that's that clip. It's worth watching the rest of that segment. We'll put a link to it, or maybe we'll embed it on our page at Majority FM. It
They brought on Steele. What's his first name? Michael Steele. And it was interesting. I mean, Hayes wanted to know if the right was going to sort of react in the same way that they did with Trayvon Martin, which is in the first couple of days come out and be like, this is an outrage. And then a couple of days later, it's like, this is just the way it should be. But the right so far seems to, I mean, it's pretty hard to not look at this and say, hey, there's a problem here. It's just how narrow you want to.
Their problem with this is a bit different than most, well, people who actually care about African Americans and black males and how the police treat them. They are looking at this as, you know, taxes in this country, that's the real problem here. The cigarette tax, that's why this guy died. That's why Eric Garner's dead.
Right, right.
Big government.
Right, right.
I mean, that's literally what Sean Hannity was saying last night. That's what you got Rand Paul out there saying on, what was it, CNN or MSNBC. I mean, literally, that is the conservative view. It's that this is a tax problem, not a race problem or a police violence against black males
country,
problems. Yes.
If we had freedom in this country, he would have been able to sell Lucy's without attracting a chokehold from a police officer. Hmm. All right.
Even Prison Planet, the InfoWars spinoff site that Alex Jones runs, their take from this was, is it now open season on people who don't want to pay the government their taxes? That's literally like, could this happen to any white person too? Like they don't, they that's how they're looking at this.
It's just, I just wonder how someone actually sort of gets that conclusion and then doesn't just sort of catch themselves in the mirror and they just start laughing.
Like Eric Garner.
I can't believe I actually wrote that.
Like Eric Garner and Cliven Bundy are at the same level. Like they both experienced the same thing.
Yes.
Except, you know, Cliven Bundy managed to point actual guns at federal agents and I think he's still alive, right?
I mean, as far as I know, he's still stealing our land. As far as I know, he is still living off the dole. What was the other? We'll talk about that in a bit. What was the other thing that we were talking about? That there was an argument that was out there about. Grumpin. Oh yeah, we'll play that audio today, because this is this is an interesting take on that. Well, it's a different story. I mean, it's so hard. I just sort of like, with all of this going on, it just seems. Small bore to get into some of these other sort of more policy-oriented issues, but maybe that's what the fun half is about, is to really just let our hair down and talk about how the implications of the right looking at the earned income tax credit as a opening to making people understand the submerged welfare state. For people who, God, that's my sense. That's folks, that's what we call around here a joke. All right, just to give you a sense of where my sense of humor has now devolved to. All right, we're going to take a break. We're headed to the better half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. Folks, we are aware also, we did an ad for Harry's yesterday, and we gave you the wrong coupon code. The Majority Report holiday is only for the Winston set. And Majority Report is just the first time buyers. I don't know what to say. I had to mention that. All right, let's take a break. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM or via the app. See you in a minute.
I give her my love. She says no. She said, oh, no.
Say no.